Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:55 Pacific Standard Time, and today is March 3rd. And today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And I thought that this week I would start off with oil. There was news today that Libya's largest oil exporting terminal had been captured and that supplies had been disrupted. Well, that is a potentially bullish factor, but you can see that prices are only up 70 cents. This is not a dynamic move. That also points to the fact that Libya is no longer a major supplier, that a large quantity of its supply has already been knocked out of the market, and that the supply and demand balance does not hinge on whether Libya is going to be the swing producer. When we look at the broader market, then we've had a considerable volatility, and there has been a bit of back and forth on Wall Street today. You can see now that the S&P is in marginally negative territory. The Nasdaq is marginally positive territory. The Snap IPO has gone pretty well. I will come back and have a broader discussion of stock markets, but there was a fascinating article I read yesterday. Freudian slip there. I read yesterday. And it was largely focusing on the granularity that is possible with marketing today based on the psychological profiles that can be built up about typical people on the internet and how they can be broken down into personality types, and their potential for buying products can be further categorized by their likes on Facebook, and not only their likes on Facebook, but how individuals are watching TV, how they're watching YouTube, how they're watching Netflix, how they use their Gmail account, how they use their Hotmail account, how they are engaging with their Xbox, how we engage with absolutely everything that is connected to the internet. These all represent metadata. And then we can say that it is artificial intelligence can put all of this together. But of course, artificial intelligence is dependent on data, that this is a chicken and egg type scenario, that we have had people trying to develop artificial intelligence for decades, but in many respects it was an academic exercise because there simply wasn't the digitized economy in which to really give full flight to the potential. Well, that is rapidly changing, and we are already looking at the thin edge of a very wide wedge. When we think about the amount of data that is collected from individuals, what we're really talking about is maybe 300 or 400 likes on Facebook, browsing history, how we use our email, what are the kinds of articles that we read, how long do we spend on them. These are small pieces of data, but they coalesce to create a broader picture. And then it can be harvested and then employed by corporations. So the focus of the article from Gizmag I posted yesterday was on politics. And politics is obviously very important, and there are a substantial number of column inches devoted to it. But the ability to market your products on a granular basis to at the kind of customer you think is most likely to buy your product is an enormously powerful tool. And it is something that is being offered by an increasing number of companies, but they are all dependent on the metadata that is harvested by the big data companies like Google and like Facebook and their ilk. So those types of companies are doing rather well. When we look at Google, then we're presented with a pretty significant medium-term uptrend. And is it a little bit overbought in the short term? Yes, it is. Does that look like any kind of top formation characteristic? I think the answer is no. Facebook remains in a very consistent advance. It is somewhat overbought relative to the trend mean, but that is characteristic for what we've seen in this trend before, and it is increasingly likely that we will get a reversion back to the mean when and there will be a dynamic move will likely signal that. Of course, these are the clear winners. Amazon is harvesting a great deal of data from all of us, not only through its shopping sites, but obviously through its provision of server facilities for large numbers of companies, and it is at a new fresh high as well. There are, of course, losers, and the clear losers are the smaller companies, those that have not yet been able to commercialize the metadata that they are collecting. Yelp is just about hanging in there. Twitter is still in a downtrend. And then you have TripAdvisor, which has, in no uncertain terms, lost out to what has been a particularly fine growth story for Priceline, which also owns Bookings.com. And that is a very clear breakout from a well-defined range, although it is somewhat overbought in the short term. And against that background, where all of this metadata is being used to create very targeted messages, then WPP, which is a broad spectrum advertising agency, is going to have some difficulty. They are going to have to continue to evolve the kind of product offering that they have, because that is a clear weekly key reversal, and it is now testing the region of the trend mean, and it needs to rally in a hurry. This does not represent the kind of laissez-faire trend that we have in other stocks. These are very clear downward dynamics. When the price falls, it falls in an aggressive manner, and then it takes some time to recoup the losses. So this is really a make or break moment for a share like WPP. And we get the same kind of challenge that is being represented. It isn't just for the broad spectrum marketers, but it is for the bricks and mortar type companies too. Under Armour has not been at the forefront of online shopping. They produce wonderful clothes, and I'm personally a customer of theirs, but their online experience is nothing compared to some of their competitors. And I know that when Mrs. Tracy bought me a sweatshirt over Christmas, she bought the Under Armour sweatshirt on Amazon because of the free returns, and I think the price was exactly the same as on their own website. So their marketing strategy for online is certainly not up to scratch. Ralph Lauren has it even makes you pay for your returns, and that is obviously not good news if you're trying to grow out your e-commerce. If you can't try it on at no cost, why on earth would you buy? So then you look at Walmart, and they are increasingly investing in their online offering, and they are doing so in an aggressive manner. But that was a pretty sharp downward dynamic this week, and it has broken that short-term progression of lower rally highs, but it really does now need to find support, and find support soon, if the potential for higher to lateral ranging is to be given the benefit of the doubt. When we go back and look at the wider market, and that run-through of shares just gives us some sort of idea about where are we in the cycle, how long that we are in a massive transition, that technological innovation is accelerating at such an incredibly rapid pace that it is creating very clear winners and losers, and there is this clear polarization between the winners and losers. But when I think about big data and the size of data, then I really do think we are at the thin end of the wedge, because when you think about the fact that the human brain has not yet been mapped, and that when we talk about the quantity of data that will be created in the human brain mapping project, we're no longer talking about gigs, we're not talking about megabytes, we're talking about petabytes, and that is orders of magnitude larger than the kinds of data that is being collected today. When we start talking about mapping the brain, then we haven't even done the first one yet. And it is going to take years more. The computing power to do, and if you think about the amount of computing power that Google has, all of it, they talk in the region of about 8 petabytes. And a human brain, just one human brain, will require more than that. So when we're talking about the quantity of data that there is out there that can be potentially harvested and analyzed, then this is really only the beginning. We are seeing just the beginning of a massive technological shift, a massive shift to data-driven analytics. And this is something that is going to not just be a theme that is going to play out over the next 6 months or a year. This is the new reality. This is going to affect just about every part of our lives. And most particularly, it is going to affect how we are marketed to, what do we do with our lives, and it is to be hoped that when it comes down to political decisions and how money is going to be spent and raised from citizens, that it will be driven by an analytical way of thinking rather than the highly emotive way that tends to get people elected. This week was an important one because we had two big events. The first was President Trump's first speech to Congress, and it went off without a hitch. We did not get any great deal of detail. Those questions are going to be asked. They're not being asked just yet. And today we had Janet Yellen speaking, and for someone who has spent most of her career as the Fed governor, as one of the most dovish that we have had in that position, she's beginning to turn a little more hawkish. And there's good reason for that, because, and I'm going to post a chart, it's a report from Thorsten Slok at Deutsche today. There are a number of, I think, important charts within it, and I would recommend just taking a look at it. But there were two in particular that really caught my attention. The first was that the largest single demographic in the USA is 26-year-olds. There are more 26-year-olds than any other age group. And I think these are referred to as the shadow boomers. So the baby boomers have moved into retirement, and the large number of millennials is a very large economic factor. It's likely to drive home ownership and car ownership as we move forward. A lot of those people have delayed their individual family formation, and part of the reason for that is because they have not been able to access the kind of good-paying jobs that would afford them the possibility of living independently. Then there is the clear fact that what we're starting to see is wages rising. And he produced a very good chart of which wages are rising and what was it that resulted in wages pulling back so violently in January. And it was down to the banking sector, the financial sector. Wages came back and everything else rose. Minimum wages are rising. And in major conurbations, we're seeing wages going up to $15 an hour. And I've been talking to, I was talking to my accountant, and what he was talking about was that he's not worried about the guy that's going to get $15 an hour, but that the person that he's paying to be an office, to work in his office is getting a bit more than minimum wage, so he's going to have to start paying them more. The person who's cleaning or who's mowing the lawn is going to have to start getting paid more. This is the very definition of inflation, that for doing the same work you get more money. That's the very definition of inflation. So when we think about what are the potential for interest rates to rise, I think there's ample potential for interest rates to rise. And this is perhaps the most important thing, is that the Fed has overestimated the number of interest rate hikes that it is going to impose repeatedly over the last 7 years. They haven't got it right once. So it is, to a certain extent, it is a little bit like the boy who cried wolf. They have been crying and really predicting that they're going to raise interest rates a lot, and they've never done it. But we are starting to see inflationary pressures rising. And if we are, and we are already into the 8th year of an economic expansion from a very depressed level, certainly the participation rate has declined, and that has contributed to the fact that we're at full employment because less people are working. Part of the reason that at least I contend that there are less people working is that I think there are three reasons. One is because the baby boomers are beginning to retire. That's the obvious one. The second one is that 50% of the population earn less than $30,000, and at $28,000 you have to pay for your own health care. Below $28,000, you get subsidies. You get significant subsidies for your Obamacare. If you're on the border, and then you're also paying for health care, and you're paying for child care, in many respects, you're better off not working. And that takes a lot of people out of the market. In a two-parent family, what that does is it creates a decision about who's making the most money, and the other person stays at home and watches the kids. That's part of and I think of all the initiatives that are being proposed by the Trump administration, where whether it is the simplification of the tax code, which would be wonderful, lower corporate taxes, an amnesty on foreign earnings. A transition to regional as opposed to global taxation. But if they could impose or they could bring in some form of credit or a way for families to reduce the cost of childcare, then that would unleash a large number of people who could go and find work. That could potentially feed through and help to moderate the pace of wage inflation in a single swoop. If we could have some reform of the healthcare sector, which would hold on to the pre-existing conditions mandate but reduce the overall cost, and most particularly the extraordinarily high deductibles, then that would also be a very benign scenario. But that is the modern equivalent of the Gordian knot. What the market is rallying on is on the assumption that we are going to have an infrastructure build, and we're going to have a move on taxes and deregulation, and that's contributing to the banking sector leading. And I tend to look at the regional banks index because those are purely domestic factors, and the regional banks are domestic banks. Now, we had a pretty impressive breakout this week, and it was not sustained. There is a clear overextension relative to the trend mean, and there is a clear and present risk that we are going to have some additional consolidation. And there was also the fact then, I think it is an important one, that the S&P 500 gapped higher on Wednesday. Now, we can say on one hand that that is potentially an exhaustion gap, that we have been rallying very persistently. And if we look at that daily chart, that every time one of these ranges has been completed, the S&P 500 has rallied by just less than 100 points. And this rally so far has been about 100 points. So we are at a natural area where we might get some pause and consolidation. If it's a breakaway gap, that would be very benign environment, that it is indicative of even more demand coming in, and that we are in for an additional upward leg. What we will see, though, in the next few days is which one of those it is. If it is an exhaustion gap, then we either get a somewhat deeper pullback, or we get an island reversal and it gaps lower. I personally do not think we're going to get the island reversal. I think that the most likely scenario is that we get another one of these relatively inert ranges, where the range is less than or in the region of about 100 points, because that is what we saw in the summer. That's also what we saw in the fall. And the range that we got in December and January was incredibly inert. But it is a great example of a range which was incredibly inert and gave way to an emphatic breakout. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. That is perhaps one of the most important points and one of the most important lessons from the chart seminar. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. They are like coiled springs, and when the pressure comes off, they hit a vacuum of supply above the market and surge higher. And that's why I started off the audio or the video looking at oil. Oil prices have been incredibly inert, and this is a range that is not going to last indefinitely. There hasn't been a time in the last decade that prices have been this inert. Even in 2014, what we considered was a very inert environment was more volatile than what we've had over the last 2 months in Brent crude. When this breaks, it is going to break in an emphatic way. So far, it has been a very orderly consolidation above the underlying range. There are some very big questions about oil prices over the medium term. And I think that the most important of those is at what point does supply overwhelm demand? The unconventional oil and gas market represents a profound change and a game changer for the energy sector, both in natural gas and in oil. And it is now the new swing producer. One of the most convenient characteristics of those unconventional oil wells is that they have a swift, a very swift production, but then they also have a swift production peak. You have to keep drilling. When you stop drilling, it shuts in your supply. And by shutting in your supply, all you have to do is wait for prices to go back up and you start drilling again. And that's a very, very convenient way of managing their market. And it isn't at all like the cost of trying to put a cap on an already producing well, because it is almost like nature is doing it for you with unconventional oil. And that means that, and we are at a very particular position in the futures market, because there is no arbitrage. And maybe we just look at the futures curve. We're at an incredibly inert environment. That the price today is around 55.75, and it is down to 55 in 2019, but even if you go out to 2023, so you go out nearly 6 or 7 years, there's only a $3 difference. And the cost of storage between now and then is quite substantial. It is just simply not enough to consider that what we have is a very small contango in the first 4 months of contracts, and then a backwardation between 2017 and 2019. And it's just so very tight that there's only $75, excuse me, 75 cents between the middle of 2017 and the middle and towards the end, in fact, of 2019, is just not enough to speculate. It suggests that there has been a great deal of hedging activity already taking place, that a lot of the risk that could have or that was sitting on the books of unconventional drillers has already been taken out. This is the historic oil price, and I've put it on a logs chart, and I'm going to take down to 1900, because what we're presented with are ranges and bull markets and ranges and bull market and a big range and a big bull market, and we're now in one of those big ranges. And if we go back and look at the big decline that happened in 1986, then we saw that prices did not get back up into that overhead trading range. And I am very curious to know, is that what is going to happen on this occasion? Are we going to have a volatile ranging environment potentially for another 15 years? There is a big question overhanging this entire market, and it is that Saudi Arabia is IPOing Saudi Aramco. And why on earth would they be selling the family jewels? And there is a quick question and answer. When is the best time to IPO your company? It's when you think you can get more for it than you think it's worth. And I think that that is certainly one of the potential outcomes that we are having, is that the Saudi Arabians have concluded that because battery technology is the energy density of batteries is doubling every 5 years. Well, that means that a car that is can go 250 miles today will be able to go 500 miles in 5 years, and 1,000 miles on the same charge in 10 years, and 2,000 miles in 15 years. So 15 years from now, the economic argument for owning a gasoline-powered car will be non-existent. And on top of the rather intense regulations that are coming down the pipe, and the demands for efficiency gains, then the argument for electric vehicles will be so strong that we are going to get a massive transition. And if the price of batteries comes down and artificial intelligence increases because of the quantity of data that it will have to deal with, then the potential for automated vehicles increases. And then we are in a situation, and we have to apply the Jevons paradox, that if the price comes down and the convenience improves, then demand goes up. And that would suggest that we're going to have a lot more cars on the road. That, in fact, to manage the pressure on the roads, that we are going to absolutely need to have automated vehicles, because otherwise we're just going to have traffic jams forever. And so these are, I think, quite clear themes that we can see evolving over not just the short term, but into the medium and long term. They're the kind of things that can really drive a secular bull market. And in much the same way that we have this bull market and range in oil prices, we have bull market and ranges in the stock market. And the most important point, of course, is that they don't coincide. That when oil prices are in a secular bull market, stocks go sideways. And when oil prices go sideways, stocks go up. So we definitely have this transition from a commodity cycle into which is a cycle that benefits producers, to a cycle that benefits consumers. And we are now in one of those cycles, a cycle that benefits consumers. We certainly need more infrastructure. And we need we need some reform to really help growth to take off. That if we can unshackle the economic potential of vast numbers of people by reducing the burden of red tape and regulation, then that is something that is likely to drive economic growth and corporate profits. When we look at Wall Street, then it is quite clearly being led higher by the Nasdaq 100. And the Nasdaq 100 is loaded with those types of companies that are benefiting most from the evolution of technology. The UK has broken up out of a 17-year range. And the FTSE 100 is a largely international index that is really quite leveraged to global GDP growth. And the fact that it is now breaking on the upside is representative of economic growth globally starting to pick up. Much of the focus is on whether the US will in fact be able to pass all of these stimulative measures that the Trump administration wants. And there is a great deal of commentary about the prospect of the EU breaking up or the euro dissolving. And these are very relevant questions, but they are against a background where economic activity in Europe is improving, where youth unemployment is starting to come down. And I think that youth unemployment in the EU hit a figure today that it's the lowest that it's been in the last 8 years. It's still high, but it is certainly moving in the right direction. And Japan has been range bound, and it has been such an incredibly volatile range that it is has been I wouldn't say just difficult, but almost impossible to deal with. But the most important thing that has happened on that topic's chart is that the region of 1750 has been an area of resistance since the beginning of the 1990s. And every time the price got up to that level, it collapsed and made a new low. And this time that has not happened. So if the topics can move to a new high, then potentially we are in a new growth environment. Now, if economic growth really is picking up in the major economies, and I think we can also say that that China is performing in a reasonable manner. And the fact that commodity prices are not likely to trend higher on for consecutive years is beneficial for India. The index has paused in the region of 9,000, but I suspect that it is due nothing more than a consolidation, and that this index is going to break on the upside sometime this year. The rupee is, I think, really part of the secret to India. It is now trading above the trend mean, and testing the upper side of this range. This is a pivotal point. The rupee has failed in the region of the trend mean on successive occasions since 2011. It is at a new all-time low, or pretty close to it. If it can sustain a move above the trend mean, then, and that is shown inversely here, that would be a profound signal for foreign investors. If And India has got not just a large population, but it has the largest population of young people anywhere. And unshackling their economic potential is certainly front and center of Modi's economic policies. Apple has just opened a factory in India, and they have gone from 2G to 4G overnight within the last 3 months. So that is something that is a really profound change, considering that more than 40% of people do not have bank accounts. The potential for online banking and for mobile banking is something that could be a massive growth story. Reliance Industries has built most of the infrastructure for 4G, and having spent all that money, it is now beginning to reap some of the rewards, and it has broken up out of that range. And that has been a pretty impressive move over the last 2 weeks, and that would suggest that the bull market story in India has got legs, considering that if we look at the weighting that Reliance occupies in the index, it is a substantial weighting within the Nifty. So if we then think about that in terms of the global picture, economic growth really is picking up, and that is highly beneficial for stock markets. But it's really not great news for bond markets, because bonds have been so low for so long. In fact, what we're now getting is perhaps the most benign environment that one could have wished for, that interest rates are beginning to rise because economic growth is picking up. And inflation is beginning to pick up, and that means that central banks have to act. When we look at the Merrill Lynch 10-year plus total return index, well, then we are presented with, I think, the most important chart in the world, because it has been trending higher since its existence, and it now looks like it is encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean, that it broke downwards and now it is failing in the region of the trend mean. Now, we had a similar situation in 2013. We will not have absolute confirmation that a completed top has been put in until it moves to a new reaction low and holds it. But I think the easy money has been made in the bond markets. It is going to become a lot more difficult now. And I'll never forget when I was in Boston a few years ago and this big sign over the Charles from Prudential saying that they manage $1 trillion. And what exactly do they own? And the obvious answer is bonds. The quantity of money that is invested in bonds is mind-boggling. The bond market is multiples the size of the stock market. It represents a wall of money that can move into stocks over a secular bull market period, obviously not all at once. And these are long-term factors that are, I think, really important. And sandwiched in between these is gold. Gold does best when inflation is outpacing interest rate hikes. And so far, that has not yet been the case. Gold prices at $1,234 are now right in the region of the trend mean. If we conclude that that big move in 2016 was a massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend, well, now we're in right-hand extension. We could be in a range between $1,100 and $1,400 for the medium term, and the extent to which gold can bounce from the $1,200 area will really confirm whether that is in fact a realistic outcome. Gold falls more into the category of the oil price, and if we think that oil prices are going to range, then the potential for gold prices to range for the lengthy medium term, but that range could constitute a 100% move from trough to peak, I think has to be the base case. That the most likely scenario over the medium term is that the equity market will be the best asset class to be in for the lengthy medium term, and that we are not likely to have crashes that are going to give way to secular bear markets. We will certainly have bouts of volatility, the existence of high frequency traders, and the massive move into passive investing will create occasional bouts of volatility, and they will be buying opportunities. And the any significant pullback is likely to represent a buying opportunity from the perspective of the long-term investor. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.